This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 169 was recorded on May 30th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Economic Cycle Research Institute co-founder Lakshman Achuthan joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll explore the differences between business cycles, credit cycles, and inflation cycles. And Locke will explain why he disagrees with those who are saying that all of the signs of an ending business cycle are present. We're getting rave reviews on our new expanded content, and we plan to keep giving you new content each trading day. The fourth episode of Energy Week aired yesterday with Chris Cook, Ole Hansen, and Pat Hemsworth on the panel, and we also aired All-Stars appearances featuring Dr. Pippa Malmgren and Luke Groman. Danielle DiMartino Booth's All-Star interview airs Friday morning, so be sure to follow your Macro Voices feed or go to macrovoices.com and enjoy all of the exciting new free content on the feed. And be sure to stay tuned for today's post-game segment after the feature interview. Patrick has pulled together another one of his excellent chart books. We're going to be looking at equities, bonds, and the whole macro picture in a little bit more detail because, needless to say, it's been a heck of a time in markets.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 can't seem to have any rally stick. Once again, from yesterday to today, the S&P tried to bounce off those lows, and it seems like it's rolling right over. What's your feeling here on the S&P?
You know, Patrick, I read an interesting commentary this week that I don't completely agree with, but I think it's really good for establishing the concept here, which is what this particular writer said is, look, this is a kabuki theater about the trade deal thing. They're eventually going to come up with a deal, but it's probably going to take longer than most market participants are expecting. And by the time that a trade deal comes together, it's going to be really clear that this economy is headed down for other reasons and the market is going to keep going down regardless of a trade deal. Now, I don't agree with that. I see it differently because, frankly, I don't think we can tell what the timing is of the trade deal. And I think that if a sudden rabbit out of a hat, she and Trump sat down, worked things out, and we've got a solid deal tomorrow morning, I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised if that took the S&P to new all-time highs. Temporarily, I emphasize temporarily. But I do agree with this writer that before too many months go by, we're definitely headed lower. I frankly hope that we get new all-time highs. I'm really, really hoping for that because I would love to short them. This is a very difficult market, Patrick. I do think that we have begun a cyclical bear market. I think that the top is probably in, but you know, you look at the news flow and so many moving parts. If you get the right combination of news events, we could get another big push up to an all-time high before the reality eventually takes over and we move lower. So I don't think you want to be putting new shorts on down here at these numbers because of the risk of vicious rallies. I'm actually looking at long positions on two-year treasuries as a smarter way to play a bearish view on this equity market. Now, I've got to assume your straddle trade that your big picture trading members are in has got to be very profitable by now. Have you guys taken profits? What are you doing?
Oh, we're still in the trade and short the markets, and we're looking for obviously a window from which to monetize that, but we're still riding that in there. Anyway, though, Eric, how about that U.S. dollar, though? It keeps edging to the top end of that range, just toying with a breakout, but can't seem to break to a fresh new 52-week high. Is it going to happen this time around?
Well, we did finally get a daily close over 98 yesterday. I think that was the first for this contract. And, you know, as I've said many times, it's puzzling to me that as we hit what I thought would be technical levels that would really trigger more buying and you'd see an acceleration, a good old-fashioned breakout, We haven't seen that breakout, but if I look at this chart, it's a steady grind higher, and it looks like it's set to continue. I'm a little surprised it isn't accelerating to the upside. That is reason to kind of recheck my thinking. But frankly, as I look at the many smart people who think the dollar is topping here and about to crash, I just don't see that argument. I'm still in the Jeff Snyder and Brent Johnson camp that I think a dollar liquidity squeeze globally is going to take the dollar higher against other currencies, especially the euro. The only part that surprises me is that we haven't seen that move accelerate.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because it looked like for a few days that we were stabilizing, but this morning the selling came in hard, breaking a fresh new low for the last week anyway. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, boy, what a roller coaster ride. You know, we had a new panelist, Ole Hansen, who runs the commodities desk at Saxo Bank in Copenhagen, was on the panel for Energy Week, which is on your Macro Voices feed, folks. If you didn't listen already, it was published yesterday. My first question to Ole was, why don't you just give us the quick rundown of what has happened since last Wednesday in the market? He went on for about 5 minutes, and he wasn't rambling. There was that much stuff to talk about between inventory and China trade flow, flooding in Cushing, Oklahoma, pipeline outages, trade wars. I mean, it's just everything. We did a really thorough coverage of market direction and everything else in yesterday's Energy Week, which is on your Macro Voices feed. So I'm going to focus on the things that have happened since then. There's actually a fair amount of that to talk about, because inventory was delayed by a day this week due to the U.S. holiday, Memorial Day on Monday. So our inventory numbers were not available when we published the Energy Week podcast. So on Wednesday afternoon, which is virtual Tuesday in a holiday week, API, the private service, reported a 5.2 million barrel drawdown. That's a super bullish signal on crude oil inventories in the United States. That plus news of a pipeline outage situation maybe being rectified that came out a little earlier in the day really sent the oil market screaming higher on Wednesday afternoon. Because, hey, you know, 5.2 million barrel drawdown, that's a really big deal. Well, I guess the market forgot. It was API who said that, and API is not all that accurate. We got the real numbers from EIA this morning, a de minimis 282,000 barrel drawdown, smaller than expectations. And needless to say, that was a very bearish signal. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down a de minimis 16,000 barrels, so effectively flat in Cushing. The big news was gasoline building 2.2 million barrels at the beginning of summer driving season. Distillates drawing down 1.6 million barrels. That's a little bit of a smaller drawdown than what API had anticipated, a 2.1 million barrel drawdown. Needless to say, the tape action was down, and it was down hard, with RBOB gasoline being hit the hardest because that's where the big inventory build occurred. We took out yesterday's lows, and Patrick, I'm absolutely convinced that we have begun a very significant downside price cycle, and I think this trend is going to continue. The thing is, there's just so many moving parts and so many reasons to be wary of vicious rallies along the way. Let's finish the inventory numbers, though. U.S. production ticking back up to 12.3 million barrels. That's an all-time high that was set just a few weeks ago. We've just come back up to it after the last couple of weeks just ticking down a little bit. To me, this is very, very significant, because there were people saying, okay, we saw that tick off of 12.3 down to 12.2 down to 12.1. It can only mean one thing, which is that the fall off in rig count is now translating to U.S. production's about to fall off a cliff. The sky is falling. The world's coming to an end. Oil prices are moving higher. Well, guess what? That's not happening. We're back up to that all-time high, and I won't be surprised if we move even higher. Imports, 6.8 million barrels, very small change from last week. Exports, though, up to 3.3 million barrels per day. So that means on the week, 23.2 million barrels of U.S. oil exported last week, and despite exporting those 23 million barrels, we still ended up with a drawdown on inventory of about a quarter million barrels, 282,000 barrels. Very, very clear to me that a downtrend is in play, but vicious rallies possible. I'm hoping for one of those vicious rallies. I'd like to add to my short position.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold seems to, at least today, be responding half decently to the conditions in the markets. We're slowly edging toward 1300, not there yet, but where do you think gold's going here?
You know, not too far is I guess, my most immediate reaction to that. Yes, the bullish argument is that we have moved decisively now above a downsloping trend line that had been capping the market going all the way back to February. We've very clearly broken out above that trend line. That's your bullish argument. Frankly, that's the only bullish argument that I can come up with. But Patrick, look at what's happening in the world between the threat of a military conflict with Iran, the trade wars and everything else. It would be next to impossible for gold not to catch some kind of a bid under these conditions. Yet even under these conditions, we can't even seem to get back over 1300. So what's going to happen to gold when the dollar continues to appreciate and maybe this trade war debacle turns out to not be as bad as everybody is afraid? Maybe even a deal comes together. What's going to happen to gold then? I think the answer is much lower. Until then, I think the only really strong argument for why you might consider new long positions in gold here is if you disagree with me about the U.S. dollar. If you're in the camp of someone like Simon White from Variant Perception, who we interviewed recently, who thinks the dollar is topping here, okay, well then maybe gold is bottoming and this is your chance. And we are seeing that trend line break out, and that's your signal to go ahead and go long. I don't see it that way. And I think unless you are bearish the U.S. dollar, it's hard for me to construct a bullish gold argument here.
All right. Well, let's move on to that 10-year treasury yield, because we're under 2.25. I mean, these yields continue to decline at an accelerating pace as the bond market is definitely sending signals right across the board. What's your take on this drop in yields?
Well, Patrick, I haven't checked my screen in over an hour. Is it sub 2% yet? That's the way this week is felt. Actually, I do have the screen right in front of me at 2.24 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. Patrick, it's very clear that what we've predicted on this program, remember several weeks ago when we hit 2.60 on that hawkish Fed surprise, I said, folks, this is your buy the dip opportunity right here, right now for long bonds. Well, it was the right buy the dip opportunity. That trade has been fantastically profitable, but you know, it's gone farther, faster than I thought it was going to go. And it feels to me like the prudent move here is not to be adding new longs, but to take profits on this really big move that has happened so quickly. I'm curious, though. I'm pretty sure, if I remember from listening in on one of your Big Picture Trading member webinars that you run, you guys were also long the 10-year. Are you guys still in that trade, or did you take profits already?
Yeah, we were along the 10-year and the 30-year, or at least with the TLT, the long bond. But we are doing some profit-taking here on it right across the board, or doing some risk reversal hedge wraps on them. I think the move has gone just a little too far, too fast. And it's a good time to lock in a little bit, but we'll see. It's a move that still has a lot of velocity, right? Anyway, let's move on. But before we do go on to the feature interview, give us a quick update on your efforts to secure sponsorship for the new programming so that we can keep it free for our listeners.
Patrick, we're making fantastic progress, but we still need our listeners' help. Just to be clear about specifically what we need, it's for people who work in companies that would make good sponsors for Macro Voices and who are willing to advocate for us within your organization. Please contact me. We already have three different listeners making the case on our behalf to their marketing departments, and we're beginning to make some progress and starting to get into some negotiations that may lead to sponsorship. But we need more people doing exactly the same thing. I just got an email this morning from one gentleman. So if you're able to help us in that way, it is the best thing that you can possibly do to help us keep Macro Voices free for everyone indefinitely. Meanwhile, I cannot thank the people who have donated enough. We're going to bring you a brand new show called Inside the Investment Committee next week, featuring hedge fund manager Alex Gurevich and institutional advisors Juliet DeClercq and Julian Brigden. The concept is to take you, the listener, inside the investment committee so you can hear the interaction when an institutional advisor pitches a trade idea to a fund manager, and then they discuss how to put the trade on and what the risks are and under what conditions they should abort and exit the trade and so on and so forth. The original plan was to wait until we had some kind of sponsorship revenue before introducing any more new content. So I want to let the people who made all of those $100 plus donations in the last 2 weeks know. The direct result of your donations is that we have accelerated the pace of introducing this new content. So on behalf of all of our listeners who are going to enjoy that show next week, thank you for your donations. They directly enabled our acceleration of this process of introducing more and more free content for everyone's enjoyment. And I really look forward to the help of our other listeners so that we're not going to have to keep asking for your donations. For the moment, though, please keep those donations coming. They make all the difference in the world. And for the moment, they are our sole source of income to cover our production expenses until we do secure formal sponsorship.
Okay, well, thanks for the update, Eric. So this week's featured interview guest is Ekri co-founder Lakshman Achuthan. Eric, why did we choose Lak to come onto the show this week?
Well, as our longtime listeners know, we've been struggling with this problem, which is normally we don't source our guests with any specific view. And recently, we just had a rash of, you know, everybody's telling the same story. They're very bearish. They see late cycle dynamics. And we've been looking now for somebody who's got the other side of the argument. And we've already done one interview like that last week. What Lak has done for his entire career is intentionally ignore all of the fundamentals and all the usual technicals and just focus on the cycles, looking at the cycle dynamics, timing of cycles, and so forth. So I thought, okay, if the common thread that we're hearing from all of these equity bears is they're saying late cycle dynamics, why don't we get a cycles guy to tell us whether or not we really are seeing late cycle dynamics, if that jibes with his research or not. And sure enough, it turns out that does not jibe with Locke's view. I don't want to steal his thunder, so I'll let him explain that in the interview.
All right, well, Eric's interview with Locke is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now on the program is Lakshman Achuthan, co-founder of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, or ECRI. Lakshman prepared not just one slide deck, but actually sent us four different slide decks, all of which are linked in your research roundup email, and we'll be referring to some of those throughout this interview, so I encourage you to download them. If you haven't yet registered at macrovoices.com for your free account to receive our research roundup email, you can just go to the homepage at macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Lakshman's picture on the homepage. Lak, thank you so much for joining us on the program. The reason I really have been looking forward to this particular interview is you are an analyst of cycles. You've been looking at business cycles and economic cycles for as long as anybody can remember. We're suddenly seeing this phenomenon where so many of our expert guests on this program are using the same phrase, late cycle dynamics, saying that we're very late in the current business cycle, get ready for it to end soon. And we're looking for both confirmation or opposing views. So as a cycles guy, what do you think? Are there really justifications to say that we are late in the business cycle? And for that matter, what cycles are we talking about? Because some people talk about the business cycle, some people talk about the credit cycle. Are these the same thing or are they different things? And what should we be looking for?
Well, Eric, first off, thanks a lot for having me join you today. I obviously think those are really important questions you just asked. So I'll just lead off with my quick take, which is that the concept of late cycle, which is widely used, we all hear it all the time. I think it's important to understand it's based on a huge misunderstanding of what is a cycle. How does a cycle work? Maybe looking at the past few cycles and averaging them, you think we're late in the cycle. Maybe because we're about to become, in this current expansion, the longest in U.S. history, you think that we're late cycle. Those are examples of not a lot of analysis, I think, or understanding of what the business cycle is. For the past few years, you've been hearing this, and I'm just going to pick on one guy because he can afford it, Ray Dalio. No disrespect to him at all, but I've heard him also saying this. And he believes, I think, that you're in the late part of the cycle when the demand for things is kind of pressing up against the capacity to produce them, and then interest rates are going to rise to put on the brakes, and therefore you're in the end of the cycle. But really what's going on there, and I hope we get into this during our talk today, I think we'll try to, is a confusion between the business cycle and the inflation cycle. And these are radically different things that a lot of people conflate, including the Fed. And I think it's at the heart of this mysterious kind of where are we in the cycle. Answering this really basic question, what is a business cycle? We actually have a slide on this in one of the slide decks that we provided. I think it's the Malden deck. I believe it's on slide 9. We answer this question. It was addressed by my mentor, Jeffrey H. Moore. He created the original leading indexes back in the late 50s and early 60s, 1960s. His mentor, so now we're back pre-depression in the 20s. His mentor was a man named Wesley Mitchell, and he defined what a business cycle is, what a recession is. And business cycles consist of alternating periods of expansion and recession. So when you drill into what is a recession, we have a schematic there. It's a specific sort of vicious cycle that under certain circumstances, when you have a decline in something like sales in the overall economy, that can trigger a decline in output. Right? You have a little less sales, you have a little less output, like GDP or industrial production, something like that, which in turn, under certain circumstances, this doesn't always happen, sets off a decline in employment, which in turn depresses income, which feeds back into a further decline in sales. And so you have a cascading decline from sales to production to employment to income and on and on. And it starts to spread. It starts to rev in a vicious cycle, which can spread like wildfire from industry to industry and region to region. That is what is happening when we have these recessions every once in a while, or in this case, after 10 years or so, right? That is what's going on. And it's not two down quarters of GDP. And it's not, you know, simply that the Fed put on raised interest rates. It's a very specific cycle. And this is something that's not only stood the test of time in the United States for 100 years, but since the late 70s, Jeffrey Moore, who's since he passed away in 2000, he began using that definition and developing cycle dates all around the world for 21 economies where we have those cycle dates. And it's a condition. It's been described as the Achilles heel of market-oriented economies. Free market capitalism is really the best way to organize your economy. And the Achilles heel, you know, the rough spot occasionally are these business cycle recessions.
Well, I definitely want to come back to inflation cycle versus business cycle later in this interview. But before we get there, let's just stay on this topic of, you know, we're late in the cycle. That's the phrase you're hearing everywhere. And I think the primary intention of the people saying it is they're trying to communicate, okay, maybe it's not the bottom of the ninth inning, but it's at least the eighth inning. Get ready, because before too long, the economy is going to be heading into recession. That means that we're going to see a depression in treasury yields. And probably it means that sometime, perhaps very soon, if it hasn't already, the stock market is going to top and we're going to move into a cyclical bear market in stocks. All of these things are the conclusions that a lot of people would like to draw from their belief that we are, quote, in late cycle dynamics. So are we really in late cycle dynamics, and do those predictions carry any weight as far as you're concerned based on what you're seeing in terms of how this cycle is developing?
Well, okay. So from our perspective, so again, it's a purely cyclical perspective. We're very different from other forecasters in that we are not using any econometric models to make our forecasts. We're instead using cyclical indicators to monitor where we are in the cycle, and in particular, the risk of a turn in the cycle. And we believe, I think we're on record publicly as saying this for quite some while now, that we're in the fourth growth rate cycle downturn since the Great Recession. So the last recession was 07 to 09, and we've been expanding, we've been growing ever since, which is why we're approaching the 10-year mark in this expansion. However, that has not all been in a straight line, that growth. We have had three full-blown growth rate cycle downturns and then recoveries. 2010-11 was a slowdown, 2012-13 was a slowdown, and 2015-16 was a growth rate cycle slowdown. And then we were accelerating in the second half of 16 into 17, and then we turned down again and started decelerating in 18 into 19. And so we're in the fourth growth rate cycle downturn. Every time you go into a growth rate cycle downturn, the risk of recession starts to increase. But in order to forecast a recession, which we have not done, is what we would require is for our indicators to, our leading indicators to decline in a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent manner. In terms of pronounced and persistent, you could see the leading index itself doing that. We have a number of them, which we should get into. But in terms of pervasive, they all have to be participating in the decline for it to be really objectively believable or kind of a real turn. And so we have a so-called three P's, pronounced, pervasive, and persistent decline in the growth rate. We have an absolute full-blown growth rate cycle downturn right now going on in this U.S. economy. It has not turned up yet, and therefore we're edging closer to some recession risk, but we've not made a recession call because we haven't gone to a situation where the levels in these indicators are falling in a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent way. If and when they do, and at some point they will, if not this cycle, maybe another cycle, if and when we do have a three P's downturn in the levels of these leading indicators, then what happens is, and this is how you predict a recession, a window of vulnerability opens up. It's like the economy's immune system becomes compromised, just like a person's can become compromised. And an otherwise non-recessionary shock becomes recessionary. So almost any negative shock when a window of vulnerability has opened up is a recessionary shock. And it's how you can kind of tell the difference between which shocks you have to worry about and which shocks you don't have to worry about. Is the window of vulnerability open? And today, right now, it's not open. And we've been having our share of negative shocks. You could, you know, somebody who's maybe more bearish would point around to different shocks and say these are negative. And it's not that they aren't negative. It's just that the window of vulnerability, since it's closed, makes them non-recessionary shocks for the time being.
Okay, Locke. So to summarize, just saying it's late cycle dynamics because the usual business cycle is 4 to 7 years and we're already at 10 years, that doesn't cut it. We've got to see actual indicators that are telling us the cycle is ending. And what you're saying is that you follow a number of indicators. You've got one cyclical economic downturn, which is maybe flashing yellow, but not red. What are the other indicators that you follow to tell you when a cycle is ending? How are they looking and what are they signaling?
So the idea of leading indicators, right? They start in the 50s and 60s, and as I mentioned, Jeffrey Moore, my mentor, created the original leading index, which the Commerce Department took over, and now I think the Conference Board is attempting to update. Now, that's kind of old technology in a way. It's over half a century old at this point. What we've learned in the interceding decades is very, very important. First, there are long leading indicators and short leading indicators. So you want to be looking at them in sequence. You look at long leading for your first sign of a cycle turn, then short leading, then the coincident. Stocks, listeners will be interested to know, are short leading indicators. Many market prices tend to be short leading indicators. So looking at longer leading indicators can be a little helpful in gauging some cyclical risk around different asset prices. But you can also, and what we've been doing for some time now, for decades now, is looking at leading indicators for major sectors of the economy. So we're tracking leading indexes for the manufacturing sector, for the construction sector, for the services sector. Within services, financial services on their own and non-financial services. The latter is very important because that's where about 5 out of 8 Americans work, is in non-financial services. And then using this same indicator framework, we've been developing indicators around the world. And what's very important to understand when Dr. Moore began developing international indicators in the late 70s is that he had a choice. He could either fit his leading index, and I'm doing air quotes while I talk to you on the phone. He could fit the leading index to the data that was available, or he could say, I'm going to stick with these indicators that I've been using for the United States, which are based on theory as to why they should turn, as opposed to just data mining. And in many cases, asked these different countries to start collecting data that we needed to develop our leading indicators. And as a result, we have leading indicators for 21 economies, including all the BRICS. And these indicators are built the same way with the same types of inputs. So we can very honestly compare them across borders, and their relative strength has meaning to one another. So it's really, you're comparing apples to apples when you look at, say, leading indexes for Europe or Asia or wherever in the United States. And those indicators collectively, now we've been talking about the U.S. so far, we have a growth rate cycle slowdown. Services are always a little softer on the slowdown. They're just a little less cyclical, the amplitude. Many people might not know this, but it was only in the Great Recession that the service sector actually contracted. In all the earlier recessions, services just slowed down a lot. They didn't contract. But the larger cycles in manufacturing and construction brought the overall economy down. Now, the U.S. has its slowdown. Europe obviously has its slowdown, and Asia too. So we had a synchronized global slowdown that's been going on. And, you know, there's maybe one or two spots that are bucking the trend, but generally that growth rate slowdown globally is fully intact. It's happening here in the U.S. There was, I think, some hope that the U.S. had decoupled somehow from this, but that seems to have given way. And people recognize that the U.S. growth rate cycle slowdown is also happening.
I want to come back to those international cycles in a few minutes as well. But first, let's talk about a trend which seems to be gaining a lot of popularity, not only in finance circles, but also in the public debate in the political stage, which is people are saying, look, what's really going on here is Ben Bernanke was a genius. He figured out a way using innovative new approaches to monetary policy to tame the business cycle. We don't have to worry about business cycles anymore because the Fed has figured out by expanding its balance sheet that it can basically tame the business cycle. It can eliminate this recession risk. So we don't have to have recessions anymore. And in fact, I think in the Malden deck that you sent us, you quoted a fund manager saying, look, you know, recessions are a thing of the past. We don't need to worry about them anymore. And that's led on the political stage to this whole discussion of modern monetary theory, suggesting that, hey, look, we don't have a big inflation risk right now, so it's okay to monetize and to cover a lot of government spending and entitlements and so forth just by effectively monetizing any debt that's needed in order to fund them. So what do you think about this? Is it possible that we've, Bernanke has discovered how to tame the business cycle? We don't need to worry about it anymore?
Well, that would be nice. And you might guess, and the listeners might guess that my answer is absolutely not. But this is also what you've described is not unusual in the sense that as expansions age and get longer relative to earlier expansions, people start to think, you know, they pat themselves on the back. It's kind of an attribution bias. It's a psychological effect that's actually out there where you attribute something that you perceive as being good as your own fault. And here, maybe policymakers or others are saying, hey, you know, we figured it out. We know how to extend the business cycle. And you're right. I did mention a venture capitalist who's been saying that we're not going to have any more meaningful contractions. But we can pick on Barron's. Barron's had a cover story explaining how the very existence of the business cycle may not be relevant. That's current news, right? Current headlines. Because maybe we can just create debt, the Fed can do things, or we can create other types of credit to boost the credit cycle and therefore override the business cycle and just have this continued expansion. Just so everybody understands, in the late 90s, there was the same kind of thinking. It wasn't exactly the same rationale, but with globalization and the tech boom and the supply chain management improvements, the argument was that we had arrived at the end of the business cycle. And that was just shortly after, some may remember, Francis Fukuyama had declared the end of history just about that time. So we had a lot of end of everything. And of course, nothing ended. Life went on much the same way it did before, including cycles. In the late 60s, which was the earlier long expansion, same kind of thing. The end of the business cycle because of Keynesian fine-tuning would repeal the cycle. Everybody remembers Irving Fisher, the Yale economics professor in 29, proclaiming the permanent plateau of prosperity. That was actually a couple of months inside the Great Depression. The basic issue here is that this notion of creating a lot of debt to fuel growth feels good for a little while. It does. It seems to work. The combined debt of the US, Europe, Japan, and China has risen more than 10 times the rise in their combined GDP over the past year. That's a fact. Okay. So it happened. That happened. You had a lot of debt growth and you had some GDP growth. And there was probably some connection between the two. The problem is that to do it again, you probably have to do twice as much or three times as much. We've called this the Red Queen effect after, you know, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, where the Red Queen explains to Alice that in order to stand in place, you have to run twice as fast. And to get anywhere, you got to go three times, four times, five times as fast. And I think when you start talking about getting things for free, in a sense, that's what we're talking about. You have to do more and more of this debt growth in order to kind of keep the game running. And it may be that another round is possible. Who am I to say it isn't possible? But some people might remember another book. I'm a sci-fi buff. So Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress introduced this idea called, this acronym called Tonstoppel, meaning there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And he was making the point that anything that seems free costs actually twice as much in the long run or is worthless. And that certainly is how I would kind of view this idea that you can just create more and more debt in order to subvert the business cycle. The business cycle is bigger than simply the credit cycle. As I described earlier, it's all those different elements in sales, income, employment, production. It's not just all about asset prices.
Locke, I want to come back to that in just a second. But first, you just mentioned there's no free lunch. That's a very popular expression. Another popular expression is the higher they climb, the harder they fall. Is there basis in data to believe that the longer this cycle runs, the deeper and worse the counter cycle will be? Or is there no correlation to evidence then?
That is a great question and one that I'm working on right now, to tell you the truth. And it's a nuanced answer. You know, there's no straight answer here. I'll say a few things. If you have a synchronized downturn globally, they tend to be more severe. Okay. And we don't know if the next recession is going to be a global synchronized one or not. We don't know that now today. But if it were, that would suggest something more severe. Another thing that can suggest a more severe recession is if you see some extreme, and they're not all obvious in advance, right? But if there are some extremes in the economy or in the markets, and there's a financial crisis associated with the recession, they can be more severe. That's observational looking at history. Now, digging into the data on length of expansion and severity of recession, it may actually be a little counterintuitive, because if you've had a long expansion that has been relatively low growth, the amplitude of the cycle may end up being a little softer, which would argue for a less severe recession. But that's a very nuanced kind of insight where you're looking at the amplitude of the growth over the course of the cycle.
I want to come back to inflation cycles in a minute, because I'm personally convinced that when we get the next secular bout with inflation, it's going to cause a lot of problems. But before we even go there, let's talk, you know, so many people just interchange these terms, the business cycle, the credit cycle, the inflation cycle. I think you've already made it clear these are three separate cycles. So what are the characteristics of these different cycles? And are there patterns, say, where, say, you know, inflation peaks first and then the business cycle peaks and then the credit, you know, is there a relationship, or are there predictions that you can make by examining these three separate cycles independently and comparing them?
Well, with respect to business cycle and inflation cycle, this was, so after Geoffrey Moore created leading indicators in the, you know, half century ago, in the 70s, right, we have the stagflation. And that really turned him on to the idea, the notion of inflation cycles as being something that are closely related to business cycles, but distinct. They're different. And he began working on this inflation cycle idea and determined that the inflation cycle itself actually is something quite different and is actually a bit more frequent than the business cycle. And I'll refer listeners to one of the slide decks called the Ekri-Minsky deck. And there we define and show cycles and inflation and what they are, and an inflation cycle chronology, somewhat analogous to the idea of a business cycle chronology. And what becomes immediately apparent when you're looking at those charts is that the frequency of the inflation cycle turns are many times that of business cycles. And as it turns out, they're more closely related to what we talked about earlier, growth rate cycles, the accelerations and decelerations in growth. But this causes all kinds of havoc for economists, because economists are looking at, and they've been taught to use models, which are kind of rooted in these extrapolative relationships and may equate some amount of growth with some amount of inflation. But if you're looking at two different cycles where the turning points are quite different, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. So the same way that we had stagflation in the 70s, we had kind of the mirror image of that. We had growth without inflation in the 90s. And this is very relevant today, because people are reminiscing, in particular, when I say people, I mean Powell, is reminiscing about the mid-1990s as a way that we ought to run Fed policy. But I think he has the story wrong. You see, Dr. Moore created, first he saw the inflation cycle, then he created leading indicators of inflation, and it's called the future inflation gauge. It's a leading indicator of inflation cycle turning points. And when I say inflation cycle, it's not too mysterious. It's accelerations and decelerations in CPI or PCE deflator or PPI growth. So those kinds of things. And we can have a chronology based on the cyclical turning points in those things. Now, Dr. Moore also happened to have been Greenspan's professor, and Greenspan was Fed chairman in the 90s. And in the mid 90s, there's an interesting episode that some people may remember. The Fed hiked rates in early 94 and then cut rates in 95. And that episode is one of the only episodes of preemptive Fed monetary policy moves, where they were moving ahead of actual CPI inflation as opposed to after it had moved. And it's interesting because Powell was reminiscing about this last August at Jackson Hole, talking about how Greenspan had this hunch about productivity growth allowing inflation-free growth in the 90s. But if you actually look at the data, and all this is in that Minsky deck again, the increase in productivity growth that we saw from the mid-90s through the recession, actually, into the 2000s, just continued. Productivity went up, and it stayed up there. But for some reason, which isn't explained by this productivity miracle, the Fed hiked rates in 99, right? And what does explain what happened there is a future inflation gauge. There was a cyclical upturn in underlying inflation pressures. And that becomes, I think, very relevant today. That's all history, like in a storybook stuff. But I think it's important for people to know what happened in the 90s, because the story that's out there is just dead wrong. It's important today because that same future inflation gauge, which had run up in 2016 very hard, correctly calling the reflation, turned down early last year, and we recognized it as a three P's downturn, a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent downturn in the summer of last year. And so in the context of that inflation cycle downturn, you know, the September rate hike was a big question mark, the December one doubly so. And then you see the Powell pivot. In fact, not that we would forecast a recession this way, because there's not enough observations, but when we see the Fed not cut rates after the future inflation gauge has made its cyclical downturn, if the Fed doesn't literally, like, immediately cut rates, after some period of time, there's a recession. And so, you know, just empirically, this is not how you forecast a recession. We do not make a recession forecast this way, and I make that clear in the deck. But the Fed has already made a mistake, and that was evident since last fall by staying too tight and not cutting. And so pausing, I think, you know, this is somewhat, I'm making a little bit of a joke here, but pausing is not cutting. And there's potentially still some damage being done to the economy with the rates where they are now. And as we said from our leading indicators, we're not forecasting a recession today. There's no window of vulnerability that's open, but the growth rate cycle downturn is continuing. And before anyone who is concerned about the amount of debt and the amount of money out there and how it may ultimately lead to inflation is offended, I'd like to point out, when I say cyclical indicators and these leading indicators, we're looking ahead a couple of quarters. So this inflation gauge and our leading indicators, they can turn, and they can turn quickly. What they're telling us right now is that inflation has been in a cyclical downturn is going to continue to move down for the next couple of quarters. That's it. Doesn't say anything about beyond that. They could easily turn up.
Well, maybe along those lines, or to pick up on that theme of what might happen beyond that, it seems to me, and I don't know if this plays into your cycles analysis work or not, but it seems to me like there's a really long wave cycle. And it's a cycle of public attitude about, I guess, ideology, for lack of a better word. You know, 20, 30 years ago, nobody was talking about government handouts or free college tuition or any of these things. The generally popular attitude was the government should help people by keeping taxes low. What we're seeing now is a very significant change in public attitudes that seem to me like they may not be causing any inflation yet, but I think if we were to get to the point of so-called helicopter money, if we had free college tuition and forgiveness of student debts and some of the other things that are being promoted by some politicians, that's got to be very inflationary at some point. So are the public attitudes that drive policy, which is either inflationary or non-inflationary policy, is that a cycle that we can follow as well?
Well, I think we can follow it the way you described it and think about it on our FAR radar. But to the extent that's going to show up in our leading indicators, our objective leading indicators, which look out just a couple of quarters, it'll have to seep into those underlying drivers of the inflation cycle. And so far, that's not there. The whole MMT thing is an interesting question, right? You know, in essence, it would amount to the Treasury ramping up fiscal spending funded by issuing greater and greater amounts of debt, like that Red Queen thing I was talking about, that the Fed would then buy. And the Treasury would, I guess in theory, the theory goes, they would raise taxes to counter inflation if and when it shows up. Just so everybody knows, that's the general idea. Now, I think we would worry, and I think you would worry, and a lot of people would worry about the assumption that it's easy to raise taxes to head off inflation after it rises. And in fact, you know, the very practical danger is that, and you could see it right in front of us, is that without being able to see an inflation upturn coming, inflation can surge long before the government takes any action to hike rates. You see how the fiscal side works now. It doesn't work very fast. I mean, you know, decision making is not pretty, right? It's not going to, nothing would happen very fast. So inflation can get very high and pretty entrenched pretty quickly. And at that point, you know, again, a kind of a rhetorical question, is anybody up for, is there a Paul Volcker in the house, you know, or someone with guts like he had who would just walk out and engineer a recession to kill inflation? You know, I don't see any fiscal policy makers who would be willing to do that. So that's how I would answer this. I think it's one of these kind of theory things, but in practical life, I think it could be very dangerous.
There's another aspect to this which fascinates me, which is, you know, most cycles work that I've seen over the years tends to focus on some national economy. You know, the U.S. economy looks like such and such, and the indicators suggest this and that and the other thing. But it seems to me this is really the first time I know of in recorded monetary history where all of the central banks around the world, they're not necessarily acting in an actual coordinated policy in the sense of there being a treaty or agreement about it, but effectively, just about every central bank around the world has been easing for the last several years. And it seems to me that that maybe has a unifying effect that brings these independent cycles in different nations together into one cycle. Now, since you said earlier in this interview that when you have a downturn which is global in nature, that it tends to be worse, does that mean that by having all of these central bank policies kind of unified for the last several years, that we're setting up for the entire global economy to move all together? And it sounds like that could have negative consequences if we are.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one we think about. So Japan started on this road first, right? And we've given other presentations where we explain how, while we're not analogous to Japan, we're a very different economy, some of these basic ailments are common. You know, there's a demographic issue combined with a low productivity growth issue, which ails the U.S. and Europe and even the developing world, by and large. Maybe India has an asterisk on it, but generally speaking. So the policy response for all this has been central bank focused, and some are further along in the journey than others. And Japan is probably in the vanguard at the moment. And what you end up with is, you know, you look globally, look at rates globally. So we have rates at the 10 years, I think it's below 230 today or so, but that's relatively sky high for major sovereign debt globally. And if the market is any indication, it's moving lower. And of course, you have negative rates in some economies, some major economies. So we are maybe farther along this journey. It's kind of been played out, right? You can go into negative rates is where they may be able to go. And in a synchronized global recession, there may be at least temporarily a rush to the dollar, right, as a safe haven. So there's that one aspect to consider. But then ultimately, the U.S. doesn't want to have the strongest currency around because there's all kinds of trade implications with that and may work to lower the currency, or if they lower their interest rates, and, you know, relatively speaking, they may become a little less attractive. So we're, in a way, kind of all of us are kind of circling the drain on this policy. It's been played out largely, and with the U.S. being the 800-pound gorilla in this game, as we get lower and lower in our rates, that game may be running its course. And what will ultimately have to be questioned is the presumption of higher trend growth. I think that's the thing that nobody wants to really face, is that higher trend growth may not be attainable. That may not be in the picture unless we have some productivity growth changing dynamic that presents itself. And I'll be the first to admit it's hard to predict productivity growth. That's a really, really hard thing to predict. But from everything that we're able to look at, it's hard to be emphatic or assert that there's a surge in productivity growth coming. And therefore, you know, I am worried about what happens at the next downturn. I think the Fed is worried about that, which is why they probably tried to raise rates a little too much in some sense. So they had something to cut. And when you look at, you know, different pieces of information that come out, the Bank of Japan, I think, is reported to own almost 3/4 of the ETFs in Japan. And you hear about, I think it was Yellen a couple of months ago, speculating about maybe buying equities as a way to stimulate things. So those kinds of financial market manipulations are a bit troubling in the context of that idea that there is no such thing as a free lunch. And so, you know, one of the things, the big picture here that I've always felt is that I don't know why we have to treat recessions, even the next one, which we maybe have pushed off for a while. I don't know. We'll see what the indicators say. Why we have to treat them as the end of the world, as Armageddon. They aren't. They are part and parcel of free market economies. That is how the free market works. Recessions are part of them and they serve a purpose. It is arguable that the low rate environment has kept a lot of so-called zombie companies or excess capacity or misinvestment. It has supported all those kinds of things, which are not great for productivity growth, which is one of the things that ails us here. So I certainly don't wish the collateral damage that comes with a recession on anyone, but it serves a purpose in a free market economy. It's part of how we stay healthy.
Well, Locke, I want to thank you for a fantastic interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners what you do at ECRI and what services you offer.
I love what I do at ECRI, obviously, talking about cycles and having a different perspective on the world. And what we do is manage cycle risk. So cycle risk is not a constant, right? There are times when you need insurance and there are times when you don't, and you can let things run, either on growth or inflation at home or in all these economies around the world. And so we consult with different money managers and also some corporations about managing cycle risk, looking out several quarters, maybe a year on a couple of global cycles. We could see out about a year. And that's about as far as you can see, but we do constantly update this array of leading indexes. And so we're getting new information every month.
Well, fantastic. And of course, our listeners can find more information on your website at businesscycle.com. Again, that's businesscycle.com. Locke, thanks so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Locke on the show. You know, I'm a big fan of cycles. I obviously am one of these late cycle guys. And so it's really important to always hear some different perspectives, particularly from the smartest people that have done the most work on understanding these cycles and get their perspectives on where we are in the cycles overall. What did you take away from it?
You know, as we discussed off the air, Patrick, I really think that we need to add Locke as a regular guest and get him back in 6 months or so, because this angle, as you say, of cycles is so important. And the one that I'm particularly interested in is the longer term inflation cycle. And no, I'm not predicting a return to runaway inflation next week or next month. But folks, it's coming, and it's coming someday. And it is going to be the biggest thing that's happened in our careers when it does. There's nobody in the investment business, almost, who remembers the last time. And we had inflation ending around 1980, but when's the last time we went from secular disinflation to secular inflation? Basically, the beginning of the 1970s. Who's still alive that was working in finance in 1969? That's the kind of shift that is coming. Now, is it coming next year or is it coming in 5 years? I think the cycles analysis is one of the best ways to tell that. And I'm looking forward at some point to getting Locke back just to talk about inflation cycles and when we might expect inflation to make a meaningful return.
Well, I'm looking forward to that as well. Before we move on to the chart book, though, we had some housekeeping to discuss.
Patrick, I just want to put a call out to our listeners, because as we're bringing you all of this new content, it's kind of stretched our audio editing team a little bit too thin. We need to add another freelance audio editor. Now, before anybody gets too excited, it doesn't pay very much, but it's an entry-level thing, and it's something that doesn't really require a lot of experience. It's tedious work, but it's very easy to learn how to do. The kind of stuff that's perfect for a college student or someone who's just passionate about the content and might enjoy doing what is otherwise a tedious job. If anybody's interested in being an audio editor for us, regardless of your previous experience, please drop me an email, info@macrovoices.com, and I'll let you know what's involved. But Patrick, I want to move on to our postgame chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in the Research Roundup email. It says postgame chart book. If you're not registered yet, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says looking for the downloads next to Locke's picture on the homepage. Let's dive right in here, Patrick, on page two. Well, that green box that was the danger zone, can't go through that or we could be in trouble, was our message last week. Guess what? We're through that. What comes next?
Well, you know, we obviously broke below that 2800 level on the S&P, which really does open the window that some further liquidity is potentially going to come into the market and drive it lower. But the question I had was, okay, what conditions do you want to see for a bottom, or at least what are the conditions we've seen at previous short-term bottoms that spurred the turn to the buy side and it was bought on dip? And so on pages 3 and 4, I show the breadth indicator of the percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving average, which on the S&P 500 were about 30%, which is 30% of stocks above and 70% of the stocks below their moving average. A lot of the short-term market bottoms that we have seen in the last 2 years, 3 years, have all come in when this number hit under 20%. So we're still not oversold to a level that we have seen where previous lows have come. The other interesting thing on chart four is we're showing that volatility index. And what's interesting is, even though the market broke below 2800 and broke to a little bit of a lower low, at least in this correction cycle, we have not seen that accompanied with a spike in volatility, not least to the levels we saw in early May. And I would think that usually, at least we have seen in the past, that there tends to be like a little bit of a volatility blow off as fear comes into the market to really mark that short-term low. So going back to chart two, I just think that there's still room for the S&P to continue to deteriorate. We continue to see failed rally attempts. There's no big intraday reversals that stick and are, you know, have follow through to the upside. The vulnerability down towards, 27.25, and even under the right conditions, down to 2600 to 2650 is all really possible. Like, what's interesting is that as we get down to below the next 50 S&P points, there could be some of those Charlie McElligott CTA sell signals coming in there, which could exacerbate the selling pressure coming from all the CTAs. And that could really be the fuel that drives that kind of final push lower that, at least on the short term, could mark a tradable low.
You know, I definitely see that argument, but frankly, Patrick, there's so much that could go wrong that I could easily see, not tomorrow or next week, but, you know, in coming weeks, I could easily see a retest of that Christmas low or lower. But frankly, I could also see new all-time highs because we're getting so much changing and rapidly developing news content. I mean, just imagine if we really do get into an Iran military strike situation and an outright breakdown in Chinese trade negotiations to the point where China really does, you know, stay the course and truly continue this this ban on export of rare earths, and that whole situation escalates, and we're going to war with Iran and everything else. I could easily see taking out that Christmas low to the downside. If you were to see John Bolton get fired and President Trump kind of walk back away from the war talk and come up with a China deal at the same time, I could see a panic rally to new all-time highs. And it's I kind of emotionally want to short this market. I don't dare to short the market down here because I see that vicious rally risk. And it's so easy to get whipsawed in an environment like this.
Well, you know, I still remain in the camp that this is one very big, large topping formation, and that that we are in the starting points of a bear market. So, to me, I have that downwards bias, quite the opposite of Brent Johnson, but that's what makes a market, right? And at this stage, though, I think the most important thing technically that I'm looking for is where is there going to be a short-term low? Because I don't think we're going to take out the December bottoms in one shot. I think that a drop down to those levels is probably reserved for like a September, October style sell-off. And I think that once this wave of selling subsides, that there'll be some bounces and mean reversion into the summer, and then we could see how the price action develops into there before making the next market call.
Well, I would love to see a summer rally to new all-time highs because then I could short it.
Well, for sure. Anyway, moving on to chart number five. Chart five and six, I put on the two-year treasury bond and the long bond on page six. Both are obviously showing us that we are having a huge rally in bonds right now. That 2 year is ripping higher. You know, kudos and a shout out to Alex Gurevich, who when he was on our show, he was talking about going long that 2 year treasury note, and it's just been a great trade. It's been a ripping higher. I though continue to believe on the very short term that this move may be a little bit overdone. And it was interesting is that I've been recently taking some profits on my TLTs with members, and it was on page six where I snipped a little tweet from Jeffrey Gundlach, who basically said that in the tweet that long maturity U.S. Treasury price action today was consistent with a blow-off momentum top, and I suspect buyer's remorse will set in fairly soon. Even Jeffrey talking about how this has gone a little too far too fast, and it's going to be interesting. I still remain in bigger picture bullish bonds, but I do think that on the short term, this is a little bit ahead of itself. What do you think?
Yeah, Patrick, I see your argument, and certainly on the 2 year especially, and for full disclosure purposes, I am long 2 year treasury futures myself right now. It's true that it's already kind of run very well. It is, as Alex described that trade, it is just such a perfect way to play this environment. And the reason I'm still in that trade, although I do agree with you that it has run quite a way here, is that I see it as a much safer way to express a bearish view on stocks. There are so many risks that could create a sudden and unexpected vicious rally in stocks. The only way, Patrick, that I can see two-year treasuries moving dramatically down in price, meaning higher in yield, is if the Fed were to surprise everyone and say, yep, we're hiking after all. Time to keep that hiking cycle going. This economy is going so strong, we need to make sure that we fight inflation by hiking rates. What are the odds of that happening? Now, I think that the market has already pretty much baked in that a 50 basis point cut is coming sometime in the next year. Nobody knows when. And so it has gotten ahead of itself, but I'm still comfortable being long here.
All right. Well, moving on to charts 7 and 8, what I just thought was really interesting was looking at that euro dollar spread between June 2019 and June 2020. When you're looking at those LIBOR rates, you're seeing that we're now down to minus 56 basis points on that spread, which is now the market baking in more than two rate cuts in the immediate 1 year future. And so once again, it shows that the market continues to anticipate that the Fed is going to provide some form of ease in the markets. And what's interesting is that when you go to chart 8, it was a chart that Michael Wilson at Morgan Stanley was talking about, which was their U.S. cycle indicator. And even though LAC was on here during the session talking about that he hasn't seen the business cycle turn yet, like for an outright recession, what is interesting is the Morgan Stanley U.S. cycle indicator has in fact signaled red for a downturn. And so it, at least one other strategist out there is already seeing that cycle turn.
Well, and Locke was very clear saying we're not quite there yet. You know, in the way they do their calculations, he hasn't seen his indicator turn from yellow to red the way the Morgan Stanley one did, but it just did. And so who knows what's coming next?
Oh, for sure. I wanted to move on in chart 9 and 10, and 11 actually, the next three charts here. What I have is that U.S. corporate high yield credit spread, the OAS credit spread, showing that, you know, where the yield over on the high yield is over treasury, which we're hovering around 420 basis points. But it's interesting, back in December, we had that spike to north of 500 basis points, and it's really stepped back. But as treasury bonds are rallying here, as the yields drop on treasuries, junk bonds have paused, and that's actually causing this credit spread to widen. And it's a really interesting question to ask, are we seeing finally the rollover of this space? And that's where on charts 10 and 11, I just have the chart of the junk bonds, and you can see how, at least in the last month, they haven't upticked at all the way treasury bonds have been rallying. And even when we go to chart 11, when I have the Invesco senior loans ETF, that also has really rolled over. That was a heavy seller back in November, December. That was where a lot of the big warning signs were coming in the markets. And it seems very toppy, like it's rolling over here.
Well, and you know, I'm convinced, Patrick, and I have been convinced for several years now, that the fixed income trade of the decade is going to be shorting junk bonds when it's finally time to short junk bonds. And the big question, which has evaded many of us who have been way too early, is when is that right time? And I think we're getting closer and closer. Are we finally there? Maybe. I've been a little bit early before and lost money by jumping the gun on that particular trade, so I'm going to wait until I see a little more clear indication that it's time. But I mean, look at where this is headed. Look at the mountain of junk financing that's out there that's been accumulated in the last decade of central bank largesse. When we get into a recession and dramatically declining stock prices, you know that those spreads are going to blow out. And I think the trade there is going to be long treasuries, short junk.
I like the idea and concept, but you know, I've tried shorting junk bonds a number of times, made some money actually back in December catching that move. But the problem is the big negative carry. If you're early to this trade, you're just burning pretty hard in trying to carry this trade. And so the timing is everything in trying to play the junk. And unfortunately, I personally love to use options. And when you're going into something like these ETF options, the liquidity just isn't there to be able to access that option market very well. And so it's one of those things that I love your idea, but it's all about execution for that, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the other side of it, though, the other side of that argument is, yes, it is true that it's very easy to be early with this trade. There's a huge carry on it, so you don't want to be early. But once it does get moving and it's really clear that that move is underway, it's got a long way to go because those spreads that are, what's the OAS spread right now? 419 basis points. It can go to 1400 basis points if we get into a really serious crash situation in the stock market. And, you know, I don't know that that's going to come, but I think there's a very good chance in the next 12 months or so, you know, certainly before we get into the end of 2020, that we're going to have some serious carnage in the equity markets. And you know that spread is going to blow out when that happens.
Yeah, I agree. And that's where watching Locke's work here and when the actual recession indicators start kicking in, I think that will play an important part of timing this trade. Nonetheless, the final two charts I wanted to reference on pages 12 and 13 is I put up a chart of the German and Japanese 10-year government bond yields. And it's just worth noting that the German 10-year bond yield has now traded back to its 2016 low at minus 17 basis points. And we're once again in negative interest rate territory. And this thing looks like it's ready to break. I just can't believe that we're here this quickly out there. And when you go to the Japan, while Japan has not yet reached its 2016 low, which was like minus 30 basis points, we are definitively now trading lower than the trade range that was established in 2017. And so again, these negative interest rates in both the 10-year in Japan and Germany are really taking hold.
You know, this is deja vu to the conversation we just had about junk, Patrick, because the mistake that a lot of really, really smart people have made in the last few years is being early to the trade, which is going to be long U.S. Treasuries, short German Bunds. And quite a few famous people have been early into that trade and gotten burned from it. At some point, it's going to be time. And when it's time, boy, there's an opportunity there, too. As we close, Patrick, I want to ask one more time of our listeners, please help us with a review on iTunes. It is so important as we are working now. We need sponsorship in order to secure the funding we need to keep Macro Voices free for everyone. What's the first thing the sponsors look at? Well, how do your reviews look? How much do they like you on iTunes? So those reviews that you put on iTunes, for those of you who may not be able to afford a cash donation, the donation of your time to go into iTunes and put in that 5-star review for us and tell everybody how much you love Macro Voices really is going to make a difference, a material difference in our ability to secure the sponsorship that we need. So thank you very much in advance for writing that 5-star review on iTunes. The other thing you can do if you haven't already is to register your free account at macrovoices.com so you can receive our free Research Roundup email. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview as well as a link to the chart books that were discussed by Lack during the presentations as well as the charts we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a really interesting article from Variant Perception titled The Short CAD on Structural and Cyclical Risks in Canada, and also a really interesting piece by Ray Dalio titled Beyond the China-US Trade War. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.